Every outlet, every narrative, every news source is driven by fear. Fear is the world's native tongue, and we're left with two choices: attack or avoid. But what if there's always been a third option? Love. A radical, countercultural, courageous love.
Well, hey guys, when you were 10 years old, what did you want to be when you grew up? You remember? I remember going through phases of wanting to be a football player, then a fireman, then a policeman. Maybe you wanted to be an artist or an actress or singer or writer, movie star. Some of you maybe even dreamed of being a doctor, a nurse, a teacher. Now, how many of you, when you were a child, remember saying, you know what, I want to grow up to be an IRS agent? It's a quick show of hands here. Anybody? Probably not many. Do you know why? Because tax collectors are never popular in any society. Now, apologies to any IRS agents watching today, but come on, you didn't even want to do that as a kid. In fact, over the years, there have been different titles given to IRS agents to make it sound more attractive. And so for a while, they were called revenue agents. And then in the 90s, they began hiring what they called compliance people. Now, here's the problem. No matter how nice you try to make that name sound, you still don't want to ever get a phone call from a compliance person. That's not going to be good news. And so in ancient Israel, being a tax collector was on a whole other level. In those days, there were certain vocations that carried an additional social stigma with them. They were called the despised trades. No devout Jewish person would engage in them if they could help it. These jobs were not just unpleasant, they were actually considered immoral. And tax collectors were one of those. They were Jewish people who were collecting money for the Romans from their fellow Jews. And so they were seen as sellouts, as betrayers. They had sided with the enemies. And they were put in the same category as prostitutes and beggars. They were despised because of their occupation. Now, on top of that, they were also considered unclean. The religious leaders of the day were working under very strict purity laws. There were strict rules forbidding people to come in contact with polluted objects. And so things like human discharge or dead bodies or even women after childbirth were considered unclean. But this mindset also included certain classes of people: lepers, prostitutes, Gentiles, and yes, tax collectors. And so a devout Israelite would not even allow the hem of his robe to touch a tax collector for fear that he would become unclean. And so these purity laws, they weren't just a hygienic thing. They were a matter of who's in and who's out in society, who's acceptable and who's not. And so tax collectors were both deeply hated and they were considered unclean, contaminated. Like, don't be around them because you wouldn't want to catch what they have. And if you think this is silly, ancient, unenlightened kind of stuff, well, not so fast. Because a lot of church people, a lot of religious conservative people have carried this view into modern day. Don't hang around that person, they drink beer. Kick that person out of the church, they got divorced. Grab your guns, the Muslims are taking over, right? Contaminated, excommunicated, unclean. And what I see happening in our country is that those on the far left have also adopted a kind of fundamentalism of their own. It's part of this whole woke culture that seems to cancel and deplatform anyone who doesn't toe the line of the new thought police. And so, for example, a professional soccer player was fired from his job because his wife tweeted the words, "All lives matter." Now, the timing was incredibly insensitive, certainly. But is it worth getting fired because your spouse said what is at face value a truism? It's a sign of the times. Or there's a recent, you know, banning of people from Twitter for saying things like, males aren't females. Now, mind you, this is scientifically true. It's provable. It's been accepted as truth for all of history. And now it's been deemed hate speech and it's worthy of silencer and public shaming. Now, think what you will about these issues, but I'm commenting on the fact that we can't even discuss them. Deplatforming someone says that you can't even have a conversation with a conservative person or listen to what they say without protesting in some way, screaming, turning your back, walking out, because entering into a conversation with them would be complicity. It would be encouraging their platform. And so last year, the Christian university that I graduated from in the Midwest had a commencement speaker that a portion of the student body didn't agree with politically. And so when he stood up to talk, they also stood up and marched out of graduation at the beginning of his speech. Because we would never want to consider the viewpoint of another human being. If I listen, I might be contaminated by his hateful rhetoric. And so we've traded conservative fundamentalism for a new liberal fundamentalism. And what's behind it all? What's behind not allowing a tax collector to touch the hem of my garment? It's the same thing that's behind standing up and walking out of a commencement address. It's fear. Fear tells us that proximity with the other, with those who are different, that proximity equals contamination. Don't listen to them, deplatform them, excommunicate them. Why? Because if you're around them, you might catch what they have. But Jesus came to show us that proximity doesn't equal contamination. Proximity invites compassion. It's the third way that Jesus has called his people to. We've been exploring this all month using Dan White's great book, Love Over Fear, as a jumping off point. Jesus shows us this way in today's text. And so if you have a Bible or device, you can turn to Luke 5, 27 to 32. And today I want to explore what it looks like when love comes to town. That's the title of my message. It's also based on chapter 5 of Dan's book for those of you following along. And here's my big idea today. In order to show love to people, we need to create space for people. I talked about how tax collectors and sinners were considered a scourge to the ancient world. To be near them is to be unclean. But for all of Luke chapter 5 leading up to our text today, Jesus has been turning the whole system of purity laws on its head. And so in Luke 5:12, for example, Jesus touches a leper and heals him. Now, normally if you did that, you would become unclean. But instead of Jesus becoming unclean, the leper becomes clean. This is God's grace and compassion in action. Suddenly, it's not the uncleanness that's contagious. It's Jesus that's contagious. And he wants us to follow his lead. So we're not called to attack or avoid those who aren't like us. We're called to get in proximity with them, to create space for them so that the love of Jesus can rub off. And so I want you to look at our story today in Luke 5, verses 27 and 28. It says, and Jesus saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, follow me. And leaving everything, he rose and followed him. All right, so Levi in the story here is also known as Matthew. He would go on later to write the first gospel in our Bible of Matthew. So Levi was sitting at a tax booth beside the roadway when Jesus approached. Now think about the Pennsylvania Turnpike with those toll booths. And what now seems to cost about $150 to go from Cranberry to Dubois. You know what I'm talking about. I'm like, honey, do we have any hundreds, you know, for the next booth? So Levi's manning this toll booth, except there's no easy pass. So people would stop and they would pay their tax to Levi in order to travel on the road. So remember, this dude's a trader, a tax collector. He's a swindler. He's a sellout. So the fact that Jesus makes him into a disciple gives hope to all of us. For all of you who've ever thought, you know, Jesus could never use me, Levi proves your theory wrong. Now listen, there's probably some serious coin in that little tax booth. And so the fact that Levi hops up and he leaves it all behind to follow Jesus is significant, similar to the fishermen who just left their nets and boats and the whole family business. So we see this urgency and the brevity of Jesus' call and the radical obedience that it takes to follow him. The things that had mattered so much to Levi up until now paled in comparison with following Jesus. And guys, you know, sometimes in order to follow Jesus, you have to walk away from some stuff that you've come to rely on. Maybe even your fears and prejudices about people who are different than you. So our big idea says that in order to show love to people, we have to create space for people. And so I want us to learn today four truths about creating space for the other. Here's the first. Creating space begins with an invitation. Can you imagine Levi's shock when he received an invitation from Jesus? I mean, most people wouldn't even touch him. They would just flip him the coin real quick and avoid any contact. But Jesus walks up to the toll booth and he says, you look like somebody who should be on my team. Come with me. An invitation is a powerful thing. It makes us feel wanted and accepted. It begins to break down barriers just in the offering of the invitation. So who is it in your life that's become the other, the monster? Maybe you could change the game by extending an invitation to them. But invitations across dividing lines are rare, and here's one of the reasons. There's a new phenomenon. It started back in the 90s in these little things called chat rooms. Anybody remember chat rooms? You probably got into the internet with your AOL account, a little dial-up action, right? And then this progressed to personal blogs in the early 2000s, and now it's taken over social media by storm. It's called the expert delusion. Expert delusion happens when you think that you're an expert on a subject because you have access to information. Have you noticed how many people are suddenly experts on things like herd immunity and incubation periods and flattening the curve? I have a friend who's an epidemiologist who's ready to pull out his hair because the expert delusion says, I know that you have your PhD and you've studied the subject for 40 years, but I watched a YouTube video, so I'm ready to argue with you for days. Now that's just annoying at face value, but we're seeing it all the time. But the bigger concern is how the expert delusion is affecting relationships. It diminishes our ability to create space and extend an invitation to those we disagree with. Why? Because all this information that we're binging on tricks our ego into believing that we already know someone because we have information about them or their kind. And so we let our tribe or our Twitter feed or our favorite media outlet fill in the information blanks for us. And so they'll tell us that all black people are blank, or all evangelicals are fill in the blank, or all liberals are, or all Trump supporters are, or all protesters are. And imagine if Jesus had said, well, all tax collectors are swindlers, cheaters, liars, traitors. CNN told me so. And see, when we think that we're experts on people because we hold information about them, it's going to prevent us from ever extending an invitation or creating space for that person that's not like us. And so we'll say things like, no, I'm not talking to that person. I already know how it will go. You may say, well, I know all that I need to know about these people who are protesting for racial justice because I watched this video and I saw a Fox News story and about how they're all domestic terrorists. And I watched a Candace Owens video saying racism isn't even a thing and she's black, so she must know. And look what all those people are doing in Portland. And I've got all this information. I've got all the facts. And so I must be right. But being right without being loving is not right. And just having facts without actually sharing space with a person is a surefire way to prevent empathy from ever entering the scene. So all your facts would probably prevent you from inviting someone out for coffee who was involved in the protests in Erie, for example, to hear their story, to empathize with their situation, to consider the events of their life that led them to the moment of saying, enough is enough. See, we don't know each other. Even though we think we do, because we've been inundated by endless information about the stereotype that that person represents. Now, the only way to get over this, get past this expert delusion, and offer an invitation is by welcoming people who are not like us. Jesus wasn't hindered by the fact that all tax collectors are blank. And so he invited Levi to follow, and Levi stands up from his tax booth, he leaves everything, and he follows Jesus. But it's what happened next that really got Jesus and his boys in a lot of trouble. Look at verses 29 and 30. It says, and Levi made him a great feast in his house, and there was a large company of, now look who was there, tax collectors and others. There are the dreaded others. These are the other unmentionable sinners, too embarrassing to include on the list. They were reclining at the table with them. And the Pharisees and their scribes grumbled at his disciples, saying, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? All right. So here's the second truth I want you to see. Sharing a meal is a physical demonstration of our love. It was true then, and it's true now. Jesus is showing his disciples a third option. It's what we talked about last week. The thing that you do with the other is not attack or avoid, it's to show affection. And the disciples take the brunt of the judgment from the religious leaders for it. And again, for the disciples, this was a strange spot. They probably weren't all totally on board with bringing a tax collector onto the team, let alone getting together for a feast with a large company of tax collectors. I mean, it's one thing if you can sneak one of them through the back door, but there's no hiding all these unclean, despised people in a house. And so they start getting ridiculed for their association, but they trust Jesus. They're following his lead. He's showing them and us that when it comes to those you consider intolerable, in order to show love to them, you have to create space for them. And often Jesus did this by sharing meals. Now, there's a familiar phrase that's used three times in the Gospels to introduce us to Jesus' ministry. It begins with these familiar words. And if you're playing along, you can try to guess what goes in the blank. Ready? It's kind of like a Bible trivia game. There are three times in the Bible that starts with this phrase. The Son of Man came. Can you fill in the blank? Anyone have a guess? Share it with the person next to you. All right, so one instance says, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's one. Another famous one is, the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Okay, some of you may have gotten those two. I bet you didn't get the third one. The third one, you may not know. It's not as famous. The first two examples were statements of purpose. They tell us why he came, to serve and to save. The third is a statement of method. It tells us how he came. Are you ready for it? Luke 7:34 says, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. And you say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Jesus came eating and drinking. A glutton is someone who eats too much. A drunkard is someone who drinks too much. To be accused of these things, Jesus must have spent a lot of time eating and drinking. Meals featured so prominently in Jesus' ministry that some scholars have commented that Jesus ate his way through the Gospels. So a major part of his ministry strategy was a long meal stretching into the evening around a table with some grilled fish and a loaf of bread and a bottle of wine. I know that one of our family's lasting memories from this past summer will be the reclaiming of our dinner time. We've shared most dinners together with our family, and many of them extending 2 or 3 hours as we talked and laughed around the table. We've been doing Friday night pizza nights where we'll invite someone to join our family for a meal, and a shared table is still a powerful expression of love and acceptance. But Jesus' meals, they were often scandalous, as we see in our text. And the scandal had less to do with what he was eating than who he was eating with. And so meals were one of Jesus' primary disruptive acts. You see, in the ancient world, a shared meal was loaded with meaning. It demonstrated powerful connotations about community. And so in the class system of the day, it was forbidden to mingle with those outside your own economic class. So free-born Romans, for example, did not dine with former slaves. The heads of the aristocracy invited other aristocrats to banquet with each other, but table fellowship with the other was completely taboo. On top of that, Jews refused to eat with Gentiles, and Gentiles refused to eat with Jews. It would be seen as affirming the other person's way of life. Not much different, by the way, than when you hear today of a restaurant who won't serve a certain politician or a cake baker who won't serve a certain population because it would be seen as complicit to their beliefs. So in Jesus' day, the meal table is where people separated into their us versus them tribes. And Jesus was being closely examined for what his table fellowship was telling people about him, because meals were more than food. They represented kinship and community and welcome. And so if you want to get theological for a second, the meals of Jesus were pointing to a new world, a new kingdom, a heavenly banquet table where every tribe and tongue are represented. And so the table, even now, it invites us to a new outlook, especially toward those who are different from us. It's a demonstration of love. And here's my question for you. What if instead of filling the space between you and the other with assumptions, or filling it with information from Twitter, or filling it with hatred, what if you filled it with love expressed by the sharing of a simple human pleasure like a meal or a cup of coffee and a conversation where you did a lot of listening instead of talking? A meal could change your life. In his book, Dan White tells a story of an Israeli mountain climber, Nadav Ben Yehuda. He had trained for 2 years to scale Mount Everest, only to give up his dream in the last 300 meters from the summit. Why? It wasn't because he ran out of food, he didn't run out of energy or even oxygen. Instead, just 300 meters from the top, he saw another climber lying unconscious in the snow. Now others had climbed right past the unconscious man, leaving him for dead and focusing on the summit, which they could now see. Everest climbers routinely avoid trying to save those dying on the mountain because to do so would likely kill them both. But not Nadav. He gave up his dream of becoming the youngest Israeli climber to ever reach the summit of Everest, and instead he chose to strap the unconscious man to himself and to begin the 9-hour descent to the nearest base camp. Oh, did I mention that the man he saved was a Turkish climber, and at the time of the climb, Israeli-Turkish relations were at a boiling point, all over the news. Their countries hated each other. Later, reflecting on his heroic act while recovering from frostbite and the death of his dream, Nadav said that he didn't hesitate to save the Turkish man's life. And when asked why, he said these words, listen, he said, because we shared a meal together. See, at one of the base camps, the two men found themselves across the table from each other. And at first it was tense. They began to talk about the standoff between their two countries. But soon they found a bond. and one meal helped them to humanize one another. Who do you need to invite to a meal or to coffee? Christians should be the world leaders in love. Our witness depends on our love. So here's the third truth about making space for the other, and it's related. It's that hospitality can bring transformation. So this shared meal between Jesus and the disciples and the tax collectors and sinners, it's a beautiful picture of a biblical concept called hospitality. And hospitality is a way of creating space. And when we practice it, we begin to push away the fear of the other. It's an act that places us in proximity together. And I don't want to pretend that some kind of magic will always happen when we make space. But here's the thing. Closer proximity might not erase all our differences, but it will help to remove our fear. The Greek word for hospitality is a beautiful word. It's philoxenia. It combines the word philos, which means friend, and xenos, which means foreigner or stranger. And so what's hospitality? Hospitality is treating a stranger like a friend. Rather than fearing the other, hospitality calls us to love the other. But it won't be easy because hospitality toward those you don't agree with will be seen as a controversial act. Why? Because our entire culture has been built on the practice of exclusion. Like when you disagree with someone, you push them to the fringes. You push them to the margins so that you always feel important and in control. And exclusion says, go ahead and take a cheap shot on social media. That's how it works. Or mock them with your friends. Or cheer for their demise. And when Christians give in to the methods of exclusion, we're only confirming the world's suspicion that we lack the countercultural love that Jesus talked about. But if we'll practice hospitality, if we'll make space, we can reject exclusion and invite true transformation. Think of it this way. If you're trying to change someone's mind, what's the best way to do that? Like if you're a Democrat and you think a Trump supporter that you know is totally off his rocker, or if you're an evangelical who thinks that one of your friends who has a Black Lives Matter sign in their yard is missing the boat, how do you change someone's mind? The go-to is, well, I'm going to make my case by sending them an email or a letter with a forceful argument that lays out my case point by point. Or even better, I'm going to put up an aggressive Facebook post that hopefully they'll see. Have you ever seen that work? No. Our brains aren't designed to respond well to those things. In fact, it usually just makes people dig in even harder to their original stance. Why? Because attacking someone with facts will never change their mind. Attacking someone with facts is like trying to fight a grease fire by throwing water on it. It only makes things worse. Dan White puts it so brilliantly. He says, perhaps it's not our difference, but our distance that breeds hostility and hate and fear. And so convincing someone to change their mind begins with convincing them that you really care about them. The bridge is hospitality. I think this is the idea behind Jesus' summary statement in the text. As he and the disciples are getting opposition from the Pharisees, they're grumbling. Why do you eat with the tax collectors and sinners? Look what Jesus says in verse 31. And Jesus answered them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. So the Pharisees are asking Jesus to behave like a doctor who avoids sick people. Such a doctor clearly couldn't do his work. So Jesus Christ can't demonstrate grace unless he's with sinful people. And guess what, guys? The same is true for Christians. Jesus said, anyone can love those who are like them. But you want to demonstrate true love, true grace, true mercy? You have to get yourself around people who are totally different than you and then shock them with your affection. But to do that, you have to spend time with them. You have to create space. I promise you, these days, you're not going to argue anyone into the kingdom of God, but you just might love them in. The first thing Levi did after following Jesus was to throw a party. And so maybe like Levi, you introduced Jesus to your friends when you first became a Christian, but after a while, you lost contact with them. Your lifestyle took a kind of a divergent path. And if you're honest, some of their views and behaviors have created distance between you. They've become the other. See, hospitality isn't only having someone to your home. It's simply treating the stranger like a friend. And so it can be in the form of a text or an email, a conversation. But it's simply creating loving and empathetic space where love can take residence. That's where true transformation happens. So maybe you need to open a door for them to enter your life again. You know, there's a fascinating painting by Vincent van Gogh called The Church at Auvers. where he expresses his experience of the church. Now, I don't know if you can notice anything missing on this lovely little church if you look at it closely, but a lot of people in today's world would probably agree with Van Gogh's assessment. Do you notice the detail? Yeah, there's no door. The church is closed to anyone on the outside. It's a beautiful idea, the church, but there's no entry point for him. There's no way in. Christians, hospitality is the door, which leads me to the fourth truth about creating space for the other. And that is demonstrating love reminds us that we were once the other. You know, we often forget what our lives were like before God saved us. And all we're doing when we make space for those who are unlike us, those who we disagree with, those who are our enemies, even bitter enemies, is that we're only doing what Christ did for us first. The Bible says that we were God's enemies, but he made us his friends through the death of his son. And so we're simply following our leader. And if he hadn't made space for us, we would be without hope. Listen how Paul describes it to us in Ephesians 2, 12 and 13. He says, remember that you were at that time separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of the promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. So did you hear those words? Separated, alienated, strangers, hopeless, lacking. We were the strangers. We were the outsiders. We were the other. But from the beginning, God has sought to welcome us back. His perfect love casts out fear. It turns strangers into sons, the distanced into daughters. This is why hospitality has always been central for the people of God in the Old Testament and the New Testament. It helps us to remember our own otherness. Remember our time as alienated from God, and allow those memories to produce compassion in us. Remember when he opened the door for us to come in. You remember when I said earlier that the Pharisees lived by a strict code of clean and unclean? That when the unclean comes into contact with the clean, that the clean becomes contaminated. All of religion is based on this idea. You work very hard to become good, and you work very hard to be good enough for heaven. And if you're going to be good enough for heaven, then you have to stay away from the defiled things. You have to stay away from the bad stuff and the bad people who are unclean. And here's the difference with Jesus. When Jesus Christ touches a person, he's saying, nothing in you can make me unclean. And anything and anyone I touch, anyone I connect with, anyone I have a relationship with, no matter how defiled you feel yourself to be, no matter what's your record, no matter what you've done, no matter how ashamed you are of yourself, no matter what has been done to you, no matter how stained, no matter how low you feel, no matter how ashamed you are, no matter how guilty you are, no matter how defiled, I make you instantly clean, says Jesus. He's turned the whole thing upside down. His holiness will overcome sin. His clean begins to infect the unclean with cleanliness. That's why when you come into contact with Jesus, it completely changes the way in which you relate to people, to the other. You can overwhelm other people with love and hospitality, and you reach out to people who don't think they deserve a platform, and you're not afraid of them anymore. You've chosen love over fear. This is the way of Jesus. And I think every Christian needs to ask yourself this question. Does your life reflect a news outlet? Does your life reflect a political party? Does your life reflect the values of your friends? Or does your life reflect the ways of Jesus? Jesus consistently created space for the other. He had a party with tax collectors. And so I'd like to challenge you to take this next step this week. Would you create space for one person who's different than you? Make the invitation. Practice hospitality. Share a meal or a cup of coffee or a Zoom call. Have a conversation and ask lots of questions and do a lot of listening. Show love. That's it. And I promise you, it won't be easy. Jesus and the disciples found out that you will actually risk your reputation for it. He was called a glutton and a drunk. You might be called a liberal, or you might be called a racist, a xenophobe. People might say you're just trying to be woke, or you're a sheep, or whatever the latest dumb phrase is that we've chosen to degrade others. But proximity is the only way to open the door for love. In order to love people, we need to make space for people. And I'm just convinced that the followers of Jesus should be the world leaders in love. God bless you guys.